The first time John Grogan was on Life Matters, we posed the idea that you're either a dog person or you're not. Well, it seems a lot of people are. John wrote Marley and Me a few years ago, drawing together a series of newspaper columns that featured his often errant family pet. The book went on to become an international bestseller and a Hollywood film. While Marley is no longer with us, John certainly is, and he was here to talk about his most recent book, The Longest Trip Home, which chronicles his upbringing as an all-American Catholic boy. I began by welcoming John Grogan to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
I just have to ask you about Marley and Me before we go on. Can you believe it is a phenomenon? What is it about dog people, do you think?
Well, I think phenomenon is the right word. It's, you know, when I wrote Marley and Me, I thought of it as this little book that was just about my life, starting out with my wife, and we're newlyweds, and I thought it would find a modest audience. But that book took off, and it's still going strong after, you know, 3 years. And I think there's something, not so much that about dogs necessarily as about the relationship between humans and dogs. And I think that's what Marley and Me touched on quite accidentally, but I must say, you know, I just started out sort of telling this story, not thinking it through too well. But I think what I stumbled on was a story of a relationship, of a couple growing up together and trying to figure life out. And the dog is in their midst helping them do that.
It's sort of the story of a family, but the dog's part of the family.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the secret, is that the dog can't be separated out from the fabric of the family.
So that is probably what people were responding to, firstly in your columns when you're writing at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and then later in the book.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, there's a lot of books out there about dogs, and they didn't do what Marley and Me did. And I think that what I did is that when I started writing about my dog, I on the first page, I realized I couldn't tell his story without telling the story of my wife Jenny and me. I think my first line of the book is something like, "We were young, we were in love." You know, it wasn't an opening sentence about a dog. It was an opening sentence about a relationship. And then it's that story of a couple going forward in life.
You have sort of started a trend, though. I mean,
oh yeah, there's a lot of Marley and Me knockoffs out there now.
Well, your latest writing is also very personal. In a way, more personal. You grew up outside of Detroit, and your parents were very religious.
Yes, absolutely. I lived in this little town. All the dads were automotive people, you know, factory workers or engineers or something, because it was the big three auto companies there in Detroit. And we were all Catholic families because the neighborhood was built around a Catholic church, Our Lady of Refuge. But our family, I think the whole neighborhood stood out for my parents' almost comical, over-the-top devotion to their faith. You know, the house was filled with, every room had a crucifix, a rosary. There was holy water in the medicine cabinets. At one point, I think I counted 37 Virgin Mary statues through the house. All the other kids in the neighborhood, you know, they're all Catholic kids, but they all went on normal vacations. They would go to the shore or to an amusement park. We went to Holy Miracle sites on our vacations.
I had never heard of anyone doing that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like the Grogan family, you know. It was all things Catholic. And, you know, one of my first memories was having priests at our house to do a blessing of the house, you know. So we were constantly having priests over, and my mother.
Two of your uncles were priests.
Two of my uncles were priests, and they would often come and bring their priest friends, and that we'd have mass around the dining room table, and it was just part of our life.
Yeah, actually, you could have arrived. It's St. Patrick's Day today, of course.
It is,
and you could have arrived for St. Patrick's Day, but you didn't. It was kind of, you were late, weren't you?
That's right. My parents were hoping for a St. Patrick's Day baby, you know, and I was a little late. And then they were hoping for the Feast of St. Joseph, which is March 19th, and I blew that one too. And then I arrived the next day on the first day of spring.
It's a bit of a giveaway, really, because you kind of feel like a bad boy in a good house, but really you're just doing the normal boy kind of things. You know, at that stage, you know, you're having sneaky cigarettes and trying to find pictures of ladies without any tops on.
Right. That's exactly right. That's a good point. It was pretty typical boy behavior. But I was in an environment where my parents had such high expectations. I mean, they were just hoping for the next parish priest to be coming out of one of their children. I said that if my parents could have chosen between their son becoming a Nobel laureate or the parish priest, they would have gone with the parish priest every time.
The problem was that you start questioning your faith quite early on,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of left your Catholic high school, and that was hard for them.
It was. My parents really wanted us to follow the faith like they did. They were so devoted. They would go to Mass every morning. My dad would go to Mass before he went to work in the morning. And then meanwhile, I'm growing up. This is the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. And so there's all this a flux in the society there in America. The Vietnam War was raging. The race riots were going on. The youth movement was questioning authority. Rock and roll music was coming yep. up. So there were all these things that were tugging me in that direction, and my parents were desperately holding on to this very traditional interpretation of what a good Catholic family would be. And it was hard. They were watching me as I was sort of moving away from their values. And of course, trying to be the good son, I wasn't following their itinerary, but I was trying to hide my own agenda from them. And so I was like skipping Mass, and we got very skillful at figuring out how to skip Mass and get away with it, which always involved stopping in so you could get an eye sighting of the priest so you knew who the priest was. So then when we came back home, we'd say, oh yeah, it was Father Ed on the altar today. And of course, then we'd go across the street and smoke cigarettes for the hour.
So it does explain it quite well. America's really changing, and you're questioning the faith. And I mean, it caused a lot of friction between you and your parents.
It did. You know, my parents just could not bring themselves to let it go. I mean, I think they felt that it was their, I know they thought it was their moral obligation, like their biggest mission in life, to make sure they raised their children in the faith. So even as I was going into adolescence and then out of high school
yeah.
and as a young adult, they just felt they could not just let me be my own person. And it was always, I always knew that it was based out of love and really concern for me. It wasn't, there was no hostility or anything there. But it was difficult.
And it's big. I mean, you meet Jenny and you move in together and...
Yeah, that was a big moment. I meet Jenny. She's not a Catholic. My parents loved her. You know, she's this lovely, lanky, smart young woman, and she totally charmed them. But they were concerned that she wasn't a Catholic. And then, for all these years, I'd been leading them on to think that I was the good Catholic boy,
yes.
living a chaste life, where in reality, I had girlfriends, since high school forward. And then one day we move in together with no notice, and I pick up the phone and I call them to let them know. And pretty nervous about it, but I think they're going to be all right. They'll be cool with it, They weren't cool with it, I think, is the bottom line. They were very upset, and just they felt they had failed as parents.
Your mother actually says that, doesn't she?
She said, where have we failed, Jess? And your marriage, if you ever get married, it'll be doomed now. And it was at once painful and comical. Mm. It was so...
Funny afterwards.
Funny afterwards. My wife and I tell the story. It's part of our family story now, this sort of funny... arch overreaction to this very simple thing of a couple. We weren't kids. We were like 26 years old, I think, by this point or something like that. And that really started a years-long uncomfortable relationship where my parents and I and Jenny all sort of danced around this issue.
But once you are married, of course, mm-hmm. then there's pressure to produce the grandkids.
Yeah, that was kind of funny. As the good Catholic mother, she spent so much energy for so many years trying to protect her son's chasteness. But then as soon as we were married, all the rules changed,
That's
of
right.
course. And she
That's
was,
enough with the chasteness. Get on with it.
Yeah, get on with it. And there was a very funny moment that my wife can laugh about now, where we came home after our honeymoon. We had one night to stay at my parents' before we drove back to Florida, where we lived. And my mom insisted we stay in her bedroom. And she had it all decked out like a honeymoon boudoir. She had chocolates on the pillows. And, of course, she was hoping this would entice us to get started on the grandchildren
yeah.
front. And my wife looks up, and there is a picture of the Pope staring right at the bed. And the Christ crucifixion scene is there, and the Virgin Mary. Sex was not going to happen
no.
that night.
On Life Matters today, my guest is John Grogan, who is a writer. You might recall Marley and me, and we spoke to him a few years ago about that, and we're talking really about his childhood, The Longest Trip Home, which is published by Hachette. Like a lot of people your age, my age even, you had to deal with your parents going downhill, and the book opens actually with your dad sharing some bad news with you. How did you make peace with him?
Well, I call the book The Longest Trip Home because it really covers this 40-year journey of me trying to make that peace, yeah. Starting with, it opens with me as a little six-year-old boy, as this little kid in the safe umbrella of my parents' influence. And then I make this journey where I eventually, as a young adult, break free, and we go through this sort of uncomfortable period. And as they're growing older and I'm growing into middle age, I have three kids of my own now, I realize that my relationship with them is broken, that we can't really be totally honest about issues of faith and religion and all of that. But I keep putting it off because who wants to have to deal with that? Mm. And then I get that phone call that I think all adult children someday will receive, where I realized that my parents weren't going to be there forever. My father got a bad diagnosis of leukemia, and he was always so vital. He was 87 years old and healthy and sharp as a tack. But this was a pretty serious diagnosis, and of course he wanted to fight it, but we all knew that it did not look good. And that's when I made the decision. I could have, procrastinated longer, and I almost did. But I went home alone, back to the childhood home where my story opens. Mm. And had a really beautiful and magical, I think is not too strong a word, 3-day reconciliation visit with my father, and my mother was there as well. We told a lot of family stories, and I said the things I knew I needed to say, and my dad did as well. And I think we really found that place of mutual respect and admiration for each other and for each other's differing values.
Now it's your turn to be the father. You mentioned this. You guide your own children to adulthood. They're teenagers. You feel quite strongly about not forcing your values on them.
I do, but, it's funny. I don't think you appreciate your own parents' efforts as parents until you try it yourself. And I always grew up thinking like, well, their mistake as parents is they just won't let up on these strict values that they have and let me be my own person. But I'm also seeing now, in hindsight, the beauty of that, and that there's sort of a simple beauty of a black and white clarity of having these strict values, these parameters that you live within, and you either meet them and everything's okay and you're going to heaven and life's good, or you don't and you failed. And I think what I've given my kids is a much more complicated world to deal with without those clear boundaries.
More gray.
Lots of gray areas, lots of nuance. I'm constantly talking about moral values and challenging them to think about what would you do if you could get away with it? Would you do the right thing or would you do the expedient thing? But it's difficult, and I mean it's so I do kind of see the beauty of having that sort of strong faith-based set of rules to live by, and I'm trying to do it without that, and it's complicated. And
John, I have to let you go, but before I do, I have to ask, what's it like to see Owen Wilson playing you and Jennifer Aniston playing Jenny?
Well, it was quite an out of body experience, I have to say. the first day I showed up on the movie set, it was down in Miami. And I'm standing behind the camera, and I look out, and up drives this little car, the exact car that Jenny and I had as young newlyweds. And out pops Owen Wilson, this celebrity actor that I've been following for his whole career. And the first words out of his mouth is, "I'm John Grogan." And my jaw dropped open. It's like, well, wait a second, I'm John Grogan, and why are you dressed just like I used to dress? But no, I thought Owen did a great, great job portraying me. And of course, you can imagine my wife Jenny was pretty darn pleased to be portrayed by Jennifer Aniston.
John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's the writer and journalist John Grogan. And The Longest Trip Home is published by Hachette.